Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's April 2023, and you're listening to episode 337, which is a conversation about the meaning of the word woman. Today's guest is Elisa Riddell, who is a staff writer and associate editor at Christ in Pop Culture online magazine. She's also written for Salt and Iron. Elisa has written a web-exclusive feature article for us, and her article is called What Happened to the Word Woman? And you can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. Elisa, it's good to have you back on the podcast again.
Thanks so much. It's good to be with you.
Well, we have covered this subject before over the years, and most recently we did a review based on a book that was written about this issue, but we wanted to just go a little bit more in depth with Elisa, just talking about actual meaning of words, because that's not always part of the discussion, and also the meaning of the words as people, especially maybe even the feminist movement, and women themselves have been talking about it, as opposed to, you know, men kind of interpreting what they think that is, you know, in terms of their own gender. So this is going to be a very fascinating discussion. But just to have kind of a backdrop on this, and also to have some empathy, because I know that folks could be confused, but feel very strongly about how they are particularly feeling in terms of this issue if they are personally identifying as trans. But your article opens with three sentences that I think are increasingly common in that it's being more talked about through the media in Western society and in America. And that is, these sentences, I don't know that we would have heard them more commonly in society. Quote, I am a woman trapped in a man's body. Trans women are women. And the phrase, a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman. So that's kind of what our discussion is going to focus around today. And that is the use of the word woman in this way. I mean, when people are saying those phrases, first of all, what are they talking about? And what do they mean? And how have we typically, maybe 100 years ago, thought about the word woman?
I think it's fair to say that until a few decades ago, the word woman was used to describe adult human females under the assumption that biological, psychological, and social realities were overlapping spheres, that one's body, one's mind, and one's social experiences were flexibly tethered to one another. And so under this traditional mode, if you saw someone who looked like a woman on the outside, you could make some reasonable assumptions about her that would have a decent chance of proving true. You could certainly end up being wrong, of course, and we all have experiences of misjudging or miscategorizing people. But it's a feature of human consciousness to engage in categorization and pattern recognition. We all do it all the time. We can't not do it because the world is too complex to treat every single person and every single instance as totally unique. For a host of reasons, including sexuality and safety, it's been extremely important from time immemorial for humans to know if the person they're interacting with is male or female. We have to generalize so that we can make decisions and act prudently in the world, and the faster and more accurately that we can recognize a person and their potential, the better our interactions will be. So until recently, the word woman was often used as a term denoting a person's sex, making woman interchangeable with female. Woman was also used to refer to a person's gender, to the social manifestation of sex in behavior and attitude. But in recent years, the connecting threads between the physical self, the psychological self, and the social self have been severed in our culture, and they are seen to operate totally independently of one another. My article makes the case that this cutting off of the body's meaning from the mind and from our social relations is a process that's taken place over the past six centuries, but that is really coming into full flower now in our language, in large part because we have technology that enables us to manipulate the human body in really powerful ways, things like hormonal contraceptives, cross-sex hormones, and plastic surgery. So the word woman doesn't straightforwardly refer to adult human females anymore. In popular parlance, it no longer refers to that half of humanity capable of gestating human life inside their own bodies. It's no longer about embodied maternal potential. The word woman is commonly used by transgender people to refer to what they call their gender identity, which is a pretty subjective and slippery term. It takes the word gender and tacks it onto identity. So gender is the social and cultural way that sex is lived out. It's what comes into your mind when I say masculine or feminine. And each culture has its own conventions for how their women and their men live. It's not a universal one-size-fits-all kind of thing. But identity, on the other hand, is the distinguishing character or personality of an individual. It's who I am. So gender identity combines what are roughly sex stereotypes with a person's internal psychological sense of self. Gender identity turns a cultural convention into something like a soul. So if a male says, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body," first of all, he's assuming that his self, his I am, is not his body, which is an enormous philosophical assumption worth questioning. And secondly, he's communicating that his sense of self is feminine and is thus out of alignment with a body that is somehow wrong, a body that is a prison for his real self. In this scenario, the sexed body is experienced as being an unchosen mask or veil that hides the self rather than reveals the self. And so one's body can become a source of discomfort or even psychological agony, which is called gender dysphoria, though not all people who identify as trans suffer from dysphoria. And when people say in the spirit of inclusivity that trans women are women, again, they're assuming that woman is not an embodied category. It's a psychological reality requiring social approbation. And to define woman physically is considered narrow-minded, exclusive, and essentialist. You know, so rather than saying, let's expand the acceptable cultural conventions for what maleness and femaleness can look like to include non-conforming people while respecting the integrity of the body, the transgender approach says, keep the gender conventions as they are while I change my body and change where my body is allowed to go. And if someone says a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman, they're really not saying anything at all about women, since that's a circular definition. But they are saying something very important about the act of identification. They are saying that identification, this act of I identify as fill in the blank, cannot be questioned or doubted, that identification needs no proof, that identification is basically a sacred sovereign fiat. Identification is, in Christian terminology, like special revelation. It's something that can't be known unless it is revealed. And once revealed, it calls for a response of faith rather than scrutiny. And this is why some trans people are deeply offended when someone, in their terms, misgenders them or doesn't respond in faith and affirmation towards their revealed identity. That's kind of like an atheist saying, I don't believe in God. I don't believe he speaks. The Bible isn't God's word. You know, the great I am just isn't. To many trans women, if you say, I don't believe you're a woman, they will take this as an existential denial or disbelief in their inner personal I am. I saw some trans-affirming placards recently with the slogan, I am who I say I am. And that perfectly sums it up. Personally revealed gender identity, who I say I am, not my body, but my words, reveal and define me. And because identity has been reframed as an internal, invisible, and verbal thing, it's quite fragile and in constant need of belief and affirmation from the outside. But I do want to give a caveat here. I've listened to the stories and self-descriptions of many trans people and also of detransitioners who return to identifying with their natal sex. And there are both trans and detrans people who take this path solely to attempt to alleviate their dysphoric suffering and not because they are engaged in, you know, revealing their true self in this quasi-religious way. This existentially charged identity language, while common in the trans community, is not universal. Some people are just a little more pragmatic about using medical tech to try and live in a way that hurts less. They're not trying to discover themselves or reveal themselves or force others to affirm them. They just want to pass as the other sex and then move on. They don't want to change the language or engage in the culture war, and they readily admit the reality of bimodal biological sex. And while I still don't agree with their path, it's easier to sympathize with those who choose transition basically as a pain reliever rather than those who opt into the spiritualized, linguistically controlling identity movement. Now, whether transition actually takes away the pain is an entirely different question. I think even in a best case scenario, it's still a trade-off. You know, maybe they solve one problem, but in the process create new ones. But I would recommend looking up Corinna Cohn, the host of the Hetero Dorks podcast, as well as Aaron Terrell and Aaron Kimberly, the co-hosts of the Transparency podcast. They are trans people who are not at all ideological and who've talked about their experiences in a way that has taught me so much. I was quite surprised by how much I agreed with them, and even where I don't agree, I have learned from them. So while it's common to hear the phrase, no debate, from the trans community, there are trans people and detransitioners who are willing to have rational, investigative, honest conversations about what's happening, and who share the concern to protect children and youth from making irreversible decisions they aren't competent to make. So I think it's important to recognize that trans is an extremely diverse group. They are not a monolith. And any kind of generalization, like I've been doing, like we all do, is going to be wrong somewhere. I think the T within LGBTQIA+ really should have its own drop-down list, because there are multiple groups of people taking similar medical actions for highly divergent reasons. Trans kids, trans men, and trans women have less in common than you'd think. And even within those sex and age distinctions, the motivations people have for transition really vary, from the kind that would make you shudder to the kind that would break your heart. So there's no one size fits all. It's very complex. And while my article focuses on the language part of this debate, it's important to remember the enormous amount of psychological suffering that's a driver for a lot of what's happening. And even though I think Christians should defend the traditional understanding of the words woman and man, it's good to remember that what we're really hoping for is that people who have a deeply fraught relationship with their bodies and with their sex will experience healing and wholeness in both body and mind, and will be loved and connected to their families and not be alone. That's what we should be hoping for.
Way back in August 2014, almost 10 years ago, The New Yorker magazine published an article on this topic, and it was called What is a Woman? The Dispute Between Radical Feminism and Transgenderism. And this 2014 article noted that the dispute was not new, and it began almost 40 years ago back then. And it was during the second wave feminist movement. So the author of the article writes this, quote, "In this radical feminist view, gender is less an identity than a caste position. Anyone born a man retains male privilege in society, even if he chooses to live as a woman and accept a correspondingly subordinate social position. The fact that he has a choice means that he can never understand what being a woman is really like. By extension, when trans women demand to be accepted as women, they are simply exercising another form of male entitlement. All this enrages trans women and their allies, who point to the discrimination that trans people endure. Although radical feminism is far from achieving all its goals, women have won far more formal equality than trans people have," end quote. The author goes on to write, quote, "Having rejected this supposition, radical feminists now find themselves in a position that few would have imagined when the conflict began. Shunned as reactionaries on the wrong side of sexual rights issues, it is, to them, a baffling political inversion," end quote. Now I want to fast forward to your article that refers to the now infamous tweet by Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling, in which she criticizes a news article for using the euphemism quote, people who menstruate, end quote, instead of the word, quote, women, end quote. Can you read that tweet for us and touch on its cultural significance? And why did it trigger such a backlash?
So the article Rowling retweeted was titled, "Opinion: Creating a More Equal Post-COVID-19 World for People Who Menstruate." And this article was published on devx.com on May 28th, 2020. The article discusses a worldwide crisis in sanitation, safety, hygiene, and privacy for the, quote, 1.8 billion women, girls, and gender non-binary persons who menstruate. So even though the word women is used in the body of the article, the headline very conspicuously avoids using women. So on June 6th of 2020, Rowling linked to that article and tweeted the following. People who menstruate. I'm sure there used to be a word for those people. Someone help me out. Womben, whippened, womed, end quote. So she was being kind of snarky because she was angry, understandably so. Rowling is a domestic abuse survivor, and she's very concerned about safety for women and girls, especially for the most vulnerable, women who take refuge in rape crisis centers and domestic abuse shelters, women in prison, and women and girls in states of undress in a locker room or bathroom. Rowling is a card-carrying liberal in every way you could imagine. She's not a conservative, much less being on the far right, but she's absolutely firm on the difference between males and females. And she sees that defending the word woman as adult human female is necessary to protect female-only spaces from male intrusion. She recognizes that if you change the meaning of the word woman to be more inclusive, you will lose the material meaning of that category in law and in public policy. You can't give away the word and still expect to retain the safety, privacy, and exclusivity of female-only spaces. Rowling has been one of the most beloved children's authors in recent history and has had an enormous fan base. So many kids cut their teeth on Harry Potter and could relate to this weird, misunderstood child who was disconnected from his family and created his own family through friendships, had special magical powers, and was very accepting of all different kinds of people. So when Rowling took a public stand for the definition of woman and the rights of women to single-sex spaces, many of her followers felt betrayed and turned on her and rejected her as a bigot, including many of the actors who starred in the Harry Potter movies. People burned her books. Some had their Harry Potter tattoos removed. Two of the most popular Potter fan websites distanced themselves from what they called Rowling's harmful and disproven beliefs about what it means to be a transgender person. And then the responses on Twitter itself contained an astonishing amount of violent and sexual threats against Rowling, as well as the usual name calling. A podcast called The Witch Trials of J.K. Rowling by the Free Press goes into detail about all of this if your listeners are interested. It's ironic that Rowling had her books banned by the right when they first came out because they contained magic, and now she's having her books banned by the left because she believes that males can't be included in the category of women. So she's been cast as the evil witch by both sides, sadly. But to many women, she's a hero for standing up for the definition of woman and for protecting single-sex spaces in a time when any kind of boundary or definition gets interpreted as being hateful. Rowling takes her public platform and her social power seriously, and she's really rich, so she can push back against the tide here and still be relatively safe doing it, whereas your average woman who's afraid of losing her job or losing social standing is going to find it much harder to speak her mind and say what's true because the social cost to that may be more than she can pay. I think Rowling saw herself as kind of taking one for the team because she can afford to. And this fight between feminists and transgender activists has been brewing for quite some time, at least 50 years since the second wave of feminism in the 1970s. And women like Rowling have been labeled with a slur, TERF, which stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. Some feminists have taken that on as a badge of honor, but it was originally meant in a derogatory way.
And the fight between these groups is very much over language as a proxy for entrance into single-sex spaces. Trans women will not be satisfied with simply co-opting the word woman. They want access to the bathrooms, the locker rooms, the sports teams, the rape crisis shelters, the prisons. There is no compromise where we play along and grant the word, but then draw the line at the space. So many trans women will describe themselves as feeling female. They say they have a woman's brain or perhaps a woman's soul in a man's body. And radical feminists say there's no such thing as a woman's brain or a woman's soul. They would say those conceptions of femininity that you identify with are actually a form of male oppression. They are ideas that force women into ritualized submission and second-class status in society. Now, I don't agree with radical feminists that gender and femininity are strategies created by the patriarchy to hold women back. I think gender is, by and large, flexibly rooted in biology. But I do agree with radical feminists when they draw a line in the sand between male and female. Radical feminists will say, I don't care about your feelings. I care about your genitals and making sure that they and that you don't go into spaces where you are not wanted. They're very explicit. They're very feisty. And while I don't agree with them on everything, I admire the boundary keeping. You know, we're in a time where exclusivity is considered the cardinal sin. And so it takes courage to say, no, you're not included, especially if you're on the left, because the left prides itself on being inclusive and sticking up for the marginalized and being open to everyone and everything. But this fight between TERFs and trans right activists is revealing that having a worldview in which all boundaries and borders and definitions are bad is unsustainable. It's certainly possible to have too many boundaries, but it's also possible to not have enough.
I know, that's just so interesting that the definition that the feminist movement gave to woman is so much different. It wasn't, they were trying to say that it's not in these stereotypes that now trans women are identifying it as, like it's being feminine or some expression of that. So just thinking about all those things, you know, your article is asking what even happened to the word woman. And part of what you write about hinges on, surprisingly, a critique of ideas that was articulated by the 14th century philosopher William of Ockham. Can you tell us, explain to us, where you think he went wrong and how his ideas are factoring into this particular cultural moment about how we use words and what we believe those words mean, depending on who we are?
Yes. So William of Ockham is probably one of the more familiar names among the medieval scholastics. Folks may recognize his name from the phrase Occam's razor, which refers to Occam's presupposition that simpler explanations are always preferable to complex ones. So Occam's razor sliced off and dispensed with many aspects of philosophy that were well established for centuries. He employed what's called the principle of parsimony, the simpler, the better, or the simpler, the truer, to disregard one of the cornerstones of medieval Christian Platonism. And this foundational concept was that created things don't just have their own individual particular existence, but they also participate in an overarching nature, a universal category or archetype to which they belong. And these universal categories were thought to exist as ideas in God's mind. So God, who is the Logos with a capital L, not only creates individual things like this particular sparrow or that particular cardinal, the Logos also gives each thing its own lowercase l Logos to participate in, its own universal intelligible nature, its form, its category, in this case, bird. And in Christian Platonism, the human mind participates rationally in God's mind so that we can think God's thoughts after him. We can recognize the patterns he has created in the world and name them. And when we do that, We aren't creating categories out of thin air and imposing them. We are recognizing universal natures. And this way of viewing God and reality is what Occam applied his razor to. He said, nope, too complicated. He said, in effect, the things that are simply and solely themselves. Everything is an individual. Everything is particular. There are no Platonic forms. There are no universal ideas in the mind of God that we can participate in. He said, any categories we think we see only have existence in our heads. They are concepts that we apply to created things. They are names we impose on the world's particulars. There are no real universal categories. And the philosophy that followed in Occam's wake came to be known as nominalism because it assumed that the categorical words we use to describe things, I mean, think of any common noun, tree, bird, circle, song, man, woman, these names don't have a real existence independent of my mind. The supposed categories are purely arbitrary. In this framework, I'm only nominally a woman. I'm a woman if people call me one. I'm not a woman because I participate in a universal archetypal category in God's mind that we can all recognize. I'm not a woman because I have a certain kind of nature, a womanly logos that defines my developmental trajectory and my embodied maternal potential. None of that, according to Occam. I'm a woman in name only, by human convention. Those are the assumptions that nominalism handed down to us. And I think it's fairly obvious that the inheritance of Occam's razor looks like the quotes I shared earlier. You know, a woman is anyone who identifies as a woman, and I am who I say I am. And you may be wondering, given the very disturbing fallout from this philosophy, why would Occam and the nominalists after him believe this? What's the motivation beyond just preferring simplicity? Well, Occam and others like him, including the philosopher Gabriel Biel, had theological motivations too, which is part of why this matters for Christians to understand. The nominalists assumed that God's being and creaturely being are of the same sort. When we say God exists and I exist, the word exist means the exact same thing in both sentences. Existence is existence. To be is to be. But the more traditional understanding was that our existence is only analogous to God's existence. We participate in his being. That's how we're alive right now. All our existence is donated. But our being isn't the same kind as God's. But the nominalists changed this analogous participatory connection between God's being and ours and reframed it as univocal, as identical. And what this means is that the creator and his creation now exist on the same plane, which introduces the possibility of competition between them. And the nominalists were concerned to protect God's sovereign freedom from any kind of limitation other than logical limitations, like God can't create a square circle. That's a purely logical limitation on God's power. They didn't mind that. But they were worried that if God gave creatures, including humans, a universal nature and archetypal path by which each individual would flourish, then that would ostensibly limit God's freedom. The nominalists didn't want nature to have a nature because they viewed God and the universe as competitors for the same slices of agency in the agency pie. And if creatures had freedom to follow and fulfill their universal natures, then God's hands were tied somehow. And he was no longer free to exercise his sovereign declarative fiat, his let there be. So this was an enormous motivation to shave off universal categories in God's mind, because what mattered most to them was the unfettered expression of God's arbitrary will, which was bound by nothing, not even by his own goodness. I mean, Occam even thought that if God had wanted to, he could have declared that murder was good and charity was bad. God just decided to not do that, but he could have, and he still reserves the right to change things up. That's the kind of power and will that God has in this philosophical framing of things, totally unmoored from any contours of nature, including the goodness of his own nature. In the words of Charles Taylor, the nominalists conceived of a God, quote, whose sovereignty was defined in terms of the endless freedom of fiat, end quote. And that's the through line that I follow in my article, the endless freedom of fiat, the ascendancy of the declarative will above everything else, the sovereign will that arbitrarily decides what's what. And so to bring it back to that trans placard, you know, I am who I say I am. It's not God's sovereign will that's calling the shots now in our current cultural framework. It's our will.
I think you're going to find today's conversation with Alisa to be very thought-provoking and provocative. And it's one of those kind of episodes that you're going to want to talk about with a friend. So please do share this episode on your social media accounts. Or if you don't have social media, you can email it or text it to a friend. Or you can just simply tell a friend about it, because you would have some good conversation talking about the content of this episode. And speaking of that, we want more people to find out about the Postmodern Realities podcast. And the best way to do that is, of course, to help us with the algorithm on the internet. Please do go to Apple Podcasts, which is the best place where there are the most reviews, where the internet will recommend podcasts to people. And I know it takes a few moments, so we're grateful for the gift of your time to log in and to do that. And as I said, in past episodes, we haven't had a new written review of just one or two sentences since September 2022. Please be the first person in 2023 to give us a review. And we are so grateful. And now back to my conversation with Alisa. In addition to these philosophical controversies that you're talking about, you know, there were also religious changes in history. So more than 500 years ago now, there was the Protestant Reformation in the Western Church. And you say in your article that that contributed to a worldview in which we can have the statement, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, and have that be plausible. So can you tell our listeners, what's the connection between these theological shifts from a long time ago, more than 500 years ago, and today's linguistic trends as we think about the actual, you know, how what we think the word is meaning now?
You can hear in that statement, I'm a woman trapped in a man's body, a disconnect between identity and embodiment, a separation between self and body. And that attitude contains two assumptions. One, my body isn't me. And two, I am somehow better than my body, or my visible body is wrong, but this inner invisible me is right. And this favoring of the incorporeal over the corporeal, of the invisible over the visible, was very much a part of the reformers' attitudes. And you can kind of see why. I mean, they saw a lot of corruption in the visible body of the Roman Catholic Church. They saw scandal in the institution, and they wanted to, in a sense, save the spirit of the church from the body of the church, if that makes sense. They saw themselves as bringing renewal along the lines of the Old Testament prophets who rebuked Israel for hypocrisy in the performance of the temple's rituals and sacrifices. They were saying, look, the externals are distracting you from the spirit. God doesn't just want your sacrifices. He wants a broken and contrite heart. So there was something really good in the reformers' intentions here. But in this emphasis on the spiritual invisible church as being the real church, in contrast to the visible embodied church, which made rules, imposed limits, and operated with authority, reformers were trying to find a way to unhitch themselves from the authority of the visible church. They needed a way to see that authority as illegitimate. And a way to get out from under the thumb of those traditions and limits is to say that the visible church isn't the real one. It's a fake. It's wrong. It's the Whore of Babylon. You can't trust what you see with your eyes. The real church is the spiritual one. It's not tied down to any particular structure or building or hierarchy or history. That's much too concrete. The invisible church is trapped under the rule of the corrupt visible body. And this rejection of the visible materiality of the church also showed up in iconoclasm, in the stripping of sacred images from churches, in the slimming down of the sacraments from 7 to 2, in the idea that Christ is only spiritually present in the Eucharist, but he's not really present because that's just too fleshy, that's too concrete, it's too much body, right? Calvin called iconography a subterfuge, which is a form of deception. It's appearing like one thing, but the reality underneath is something else entirely. So there's this simultaneous downplaying of the physical. Matter doesn't matter. As well as this idea that appearances can be deceiving. The material world doesn't participate incarnationally in God. It doesn't reveal God. It hides God. It distracts from God. It competes with God. And so we need less sacramentality and less liturgical ritual in the sanctuary. There's this assumption that the sacred resides not in particular objects or spaces, but in states of consciousness. So what is seen can't participate in or convey what is unseen, or put another way, the body lies. And so this is where some of the iconoclastic sentiments of Protestantism, I think, have paved the way for the concept of gender identity, which is kind of the trans equivalent of the invisible church. The invisible gender identity is the true self, the real self, and this sexed body of mine isn't just not me, it's also deceptive. It distracts others from recognizing my true self, and it needs to be changed. This visible body doesn't have any authority to limit me or constrain me, but I have authority within myself to make my body conform to my mind. And all of the reality, authority, identity, and sacredness is withdrawn from the physical and is consolidated into the soul, basically. So I see this concept of gender identity as being kind of downstream from Protestantism, as a spiritual but not religious heresy that shares the iconoclastic mood of the Reformation, even though it's obviously devoid of all the doctrine and practice. But there's a family resemblance in their common disinclination towards embodiment. So if you apply this perspective to language, to the word woman, it kind of makes sense that woman would cease to be about physical embodiment and would instead refer to the true seat of meaning, the inner invisible self or soul. That's how a male-bodied person could say, "I'm a woman," with a straight face, because his body is not iconic and revelatory. It's a subterfuge, while his true self is this internal invisible woman. Psychological meaning replaces physical meaning. And so the words follow suit.
So how was our view of nature? And you kind of referenced this a little bit, just the change in how we saw the physical, Christians saw the physical. So how was our view of nature and our own bodies as part of the natural world transformed, you know, in the scientific revolution, which was going on at the same time as some of these changes in the church was happening during the Protestant Reformation. So there was this scientific revolution going on, and then yet that was also impacting not just religion, but also science. How was that impacting how people saw themselves?
Yeah, in so many different ways. I think it's helpful to see the scientific endeavor as fundamentally driven by our intellectual appetite, by our hunger for knowledge. And this hunger to know nature can take two different forms. One is kindled by awe and love, and the other is incited by a desire to master, manipulate, and control. And there's humility in that first hunger, an awareness of the inexhaustible moreness of reality, an awareness that nature participates in God and is an icon of him, such that knowing nature becomes a path for knowing God. And this desire to understand the world acknowledges that mystery and relationality are an indelible feature of the universe. And you'll never completely solve the mystery or get your mind and your arms completely around the world and bring the category of the unknown to an end. That's a humble hunger to know. But this other form of hunger for knowledge that is just as much, if not more, an aspect of the scientific endeavor sees the world as a series of objects to be controlled, consumed, and owned. It's not about a desire for intimacy with reality or conformity to reality, but about dominion over reality. And you can recognize here that same tension I spoke about earlier between participation and competition. You know, do we see ourselves as being in a mutual relationship with nature, as subjects participating with other subjects? Or are we outside and above nature? Is nature fundamentally other and over there, you know, pinned to the wall and ripe for the taking? And I think that the scientific revolution, particularly as it was increasingly shaped by the market incentives of industrial capitalism and now of the internet era, enabled us to cease viewing nature as our mother and to start seeing her, now it, as the mother load, as a resource rather than as a sacred arena of relationships. The scientific method taught us to hold the world at arm's length. We began to act as if nature were a soulless mechanism just so that we could get to work on it and figure it out without committing sacrilege. G.K. Chesterton called nature our little dancing sister. I mean, if the world is basically a machine, you can take it apart and figure out how it works, no problem. It's just bits and pieces, right? But if nature is your sister, if she is a subject in her own right to whom you have a responsibility, you can't just go and cut her open and start poking around. So there's a trade-off to scientific knowledge. It's not straightforwardly progress. You know, we gained control, but we lost communion. If we were going to get to the bottom of things, we had to reimagine the physical world as a dead mechanism. And that means even our bodies came to be seen as something other than ourselves. Now our bodies are a resource to be used, a lump of clay to be shaped to our ends, a vehicle that our soul drives around, an upgradable meat suit we wear that houses our gender identity. The body becomes this passive, silent, manipulable, and marketable thing in the hands of our technology.
I want to ask you about, you just said a phrase, meat suit, and I want to ask you about something you wrote in your article. As a matter of fact, the first time I heard the term meat suit was from a like a fitness instructor who's like not a Christian. She's very much into like meditation and kind of the new age spirituality. And she referred to her own body as a meat suit. Like, what are we doing with this meat suit? But what we really need to concentrate on is like our inner soul. And this is why she teaches breathing and yoga and all this stuff. So I thought that is kind of interesting just hearing you say that phrase, because I've heard it said by a non-Christian also. And you actually wrote in your article, quote, "We are plastic people serving a sovereign self through meat Lego Gnosticism. And our language reflects and facilitates this brave new world." So what do you mean by meat Lego Gnosticism, or just even the term that you were just using, meat suit? Because I thought that was a fascinating term when someone else said it that wasn't, you know, a Christian at all.
Mm-hmm. Meat Lego Gnosticism. I'm borrowing that phrase from Mary Harrington in her brilliant book, Feminism Against Progress. Harrington is the kind of person who memes first and asks questions later. So she often comes up with these spicy phrases and hot takes that, while potentially offensive, they capture something that is intuitively right. So Harrington is very skeptical of what she calls transhumanist technologies, which she defines as any kind of medical intervention that is not seeking to fix something that's gone wrong. It's not attempting to rectify a deviation from our natural potential or to bring healing after harm. But instead, it's a medical intervention that acts to upgrade human nature, or that treats something that is normal and healthy as if it were a problem in need of fixing. And under this definition, Harrington actually sees the birth control pill as the first transhumanist technology, because it treats female fertility as if it were a disease in need of daily treatment, rather than as a marker of good health, a sign that everything is in working order. The pill is the first really widespread example of a technology that hits close to home, in which we silence nature's voice or meaning and impose our will upon our own bodies. You know, we use medical tech to make the female body androgynous, basically, to make it more like a male body, which is impregnable, so that we can compete with men in the economy on a somewhat more level playing field. And the pill, as a hormonal treatment that treats female fertility as a problem to be solved with a market-based solution, not only lays the foundation for a right to abortion, because pregnancy is then seen as a treatment failure that requires a backstop of surgery to rectify. But it also lays the foundation for transgender cross-sex hormone treatment and surgery, which likewise assumes that the sexed body is wrong and somehow requires fixing. So the pill, abortion, cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers, and gender transition surgeries are all treatments that don't heal nature. They thwart it. They negate it. And because of that, I think the terms medicine and healthcare for these things is really a misnomer. Technology, yes. Medicine, no. One's natal sex, one's natural fertility, puberty, pregnancy, these are not diseases. They are gifts. So the idea of treating the body as a meat Lego flows directly from what I described earlier about the way that science has reframed the material world as a machine, and nominalistic philosophy has reframed the world as being composed of individual bits and pieces that don't have an underlying universal nature. If that's the way the world is, then we are not men and women moving toward the fulfillment of our nature. We are simply composed of bits of fleshy meat Lego that can be rearranged at will. We can get nose jobs, breast implants, Brazilian butt lifts, and liposuction. We can make embryos in a lab and purchase other people's eggs and sperm. You can get an elective mastectomy, not because you have breast cancer, but because you have gender dysphoria. And again, with the seat of meaning redefined as being in the mind and not the body, now the body must be changed to fit the psychologized identity. You can purchase the plastic surgery of reproductively non-functional genitalia of the opposite sex. You can even pay to have your sex organs removed, not to try to become the other sex, but because you identify as a eunuch and you want to be totally non-sexual. This is meat Lego Gnosticism. It's the use of technology to transcend nature because we view our bodies as prisons, as inappropriate limitations on our freedom, as an affront to our true invisible identities. The Gnosticism that cropped up in the early centuries of the church was also very much an anti-body movement, but they claimed that special knowledge or gnosis would free them from their physical constraints within an evil materiality. Our gnosis isn't a set of religious beliefs. It's transhumanist tech, but the desire is the same. It's a rejection of the inherent goodness and meaning of the body. If there is no such thing as sexed human nature, if there is no universal archetype of man or of woman that is teleological, then our bodies are just putty in our hands. Our body parts are mix and match Legos, constructible and deconstructible. And seen in this light, transgender medicine is not surprising or unique. It's of a piece with elective plastic surgery, with hormonal contraception, and even with certain practices within the fertility industry. It's the deconstruction of the person into bits and pieces that can be bought and sold in the name of freedom and self-expression.
You know, that's interesting. You brought up plastic surgery, but I think a lot of times even people who aren't thinking in those terms want to use surgical procedures to prevent things that are part of nature. In other words, I was looking at my Instagram feed and there's a young girl, she's like 30. I mean, that's not super young, but she's married. And she just said, oh, well, I've decided I don't ever want to have kids. So I'm going to have a, you know, hysterectomy. And of course, normally hysterectomies happen if you have some kind of actual medical issue, but she's perfectly fine. But she knows if she doesn't have that, maybe even if she's birth control, there's potential for her to be pregnant. So it's kind of interesting how we recognize underneath there somewhere that there might be natural things that happen to our bodies that we don't want done. So I think it's very fascinating, all of this. But I want to ask you about something that you reference in your article. You reference this framework called the semantic triangle. So what is the semantic triangle and how does it help us understand the deficiencies in both modern and postmodern uses of language? Because so much of the time now, not just with this word woman, but with a lot of words, we pour new meanings into them. And so we're at the standstill of like, how do we even discuss what words mean, especially when we talk about as Christians having a conversation with other people about truth claims about Christianity. It seems more black and white and not flexible in terms of how we see what we think words mean.
Yeah. So the semantic triangle is a framework that shows up in Aristotle, in Boethius, Augustine, and Thomas Aquinas. It's quite old, but it also has various modern reboots today. You could go and look it up online and see a diagram of it if you want. It's a very old and basic schema. It's a diagram of the dynamic feedback cycle and relationship between three things: the thoughts in our heads, the words in our mouths, and the world those words and thoughts relate to. If we go back to the original Latin terms, the corners of the semantic triangle are vox, voice or sign, conceptus, concept, and res, R-E-S, reality. But these can go by many names. You could say language, ideas, and reality, or words, thoughts, and world, or sign, subject, and object. It's what we say, what we think, and what we talk and think about. So in a traditional understanding, pre-Occam, the external reality, the objective world, implants a seed of itself into my mind. And that seed grows into an idea, a concept, a pattern of the way the world is. That means that my thoughts are a union of the world and my mind. Concepts are like the offspring of my subjective self and the objective world that is speaking to me or revealing itself to me. And I can express my ideas and my perceptions of reality through whatever words are culturally available to me. And those, of course, will be somewhat conventional. Those will be social constructions. Whether I say woman, femme, Frau, Zena, or Gynica is arbitrary, but they all refer to the same universal concept, which is not arbitrary, and which, you know, regardless of what that word sounds like, reflects a genuine recognition of a real pattern that exists in the world. This traditional view assumes an attitude of hospitality to the nature of things, a desire to conceive, articulate, and conform to what is the case. It assumes that there is a reality which is there, regardless of my feelings and perceptions. And yet it also assumes that I am potentially capable of perceiving and making contact with this reality and then communicating that in language, not perfectly and not completely, of course, but truly. The potential for that kind of knowledge and communication is there. But this meaning-making interplay of subject, sign, and object, of myself, my words, and the world, can get broken. And I think that what we refer to as modernism and postmodernism are two different ways of leaving out one of the corners of this semantic triangle. Each worldview attempts to excise a part of the triangle they don't like. And so they both go wrong, but they go wrong differently. Modernism, with its commitment to objectivity and science, is very suspicious of subjectivity, of the possibility for internal bias or wrong concepts in our heads that will misinterpret or ruin the data. So there's this adherence to empiricism and the attempt to be neutral, to treat the world as if it were just material. And there's an irony to this because the supposed scientific perspective of the world is one purged of consciousness. There's no meaning. There's only material. But the modern scientific worldview is one in which humans don't fit. We're like this tiny dot of consciousness in a sea of unconscious material, and we've kind of written ourselves out of reality. We've made ourselves into an anomaly. So modernism cuts out conceptus. It cuts out the subject, the conscious self that recognizes patterns. Postmodernism, on the other hand, it saves the self, and in fact, it crowns consciousness as king, and it cuts off the world. In postmodern subjectivism, our words don't describe the world. They constitute it. There's this deep skepticism that universal categories have any basis in physical reality. Rather, all our categories are socially constructed. Categories are simply forms of oppression perpetrated and perpetuated through language. So whoever we deem right about reality is simply the more powerful party. Speech isn't communication or dialogue. It's just rhetoric. It's a game. So while modernism claims to give us, you know, quote unquote, bare facts with no interpretive meaning attached, postmodernism claims that there is no such thing as a fact. All we have are the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we impose on other people. So both approaches are flawed, but they're flawed in such different ways that people invested in each side can't talk to each other and become increasingly polarized. And that is definitely happening in cultural arguments about the word woman. The modernists want to talk about the objectivity of biological sex, and the postmodernists want to talk about the social construction of gender, and they're just talking past one another because each side is committed to not noticing a part of that triangle. One will not give the subject its due, and the other will not give the object its due. And I definitely have more sympathy for the side that champions the meaningfulness of biological sex. And yet that side doesn't do itself any favors by arguing about chromosomes or just saying, look between your legs, because the other side can't hear you. They don't even believe that dialogue towards truth is possible. So we're going to have to engage in that messy subjectivity to have any chance of being heard and making contact with the other side. The truth is in the functioning of the whole semantic triangle of words, thoughts, and world. You cut off, you know, one leg from that three-legged stool and you're going to fall.
So in your article, you also wrote this, quote, "Language isn't solely a product of human convention, but is rooted in our pre-linguistic embodiment." So what do you mean by that statement? And how does it specifically address how the word woman is used today?
Yes, this is important. The communication and reception of signs, the process of sharing meaning between organisms, is not limited to humans. It's true that we're the only rational species with verbal language, but we are definitely not the only species that communicates. This postmodern idea that human language socially constructs reality and that there are no material facts and meanings before language involves either gross ignorance or willful blindness towards the vast and complex relationships we see in nature that are clearly communicative, sign-bearing, and meaningful. Just a handful of examples will give you a taste for the depth and richness of the nonverbal vox, so to speak, of the non-human world. Red titty monkeys form monogamous male-female pair bonds, and every morning they sit on the same branch and perform vocalized duets that last up to 5 minutes. Are they using words? No. Are they communicating important meanings? Absolutely. There's the male bowerbird, who spends countless hours building and decorating a bower, this structure that isn't a functional nest, but is purely aesthetic to attract a female, and he'll use colorful plants or bits of colored glass or bottle caps, all laid out very carefully and tastefully. And of course, he has to dance for the females too, and the ladies are very picky. So we've got avian architecture and dance. No words, but packed with meaning. And it's not just animals. Plants communicate too. If you look underneath the forest floor, there are these vast networks of mycorrhizal fungal threads that interact with tree roots and enable plants in the same vicinity to share sugars and nutrients and water. You've got mother trees that send carbon to seedlings and dying trees that donate nutrients to their neighbors. So under the forest floor, there is this language of the trees that is very relational, cooperative, and completely nonverbal. The whole of the biological world has agency and is communicating, is sending and receiving signs and meanings constantly. That's what the field of biosemiotics is all about, the study of the representation, meaning, sense, and the biological significance of sign processes, whether that's inside a cell or between animals and plants or in human symbolism and language. And this meaning not only resides in organisms' behavior, it's also present in their form, in their structural, functional organization. So on a human level, it's not only verbal language and body language that speak. our sexual form and function also speak. You know, half of humanity has the embodied potential to procreate outside of themselves, to paternally beget new life. The other half of humanity has the embodied potential to procreate inside of themselves, to maternally gestate new life. We need to remember that sex is millions of years old. It predates language and it predates humanity. The form and function of our sex bodies communicates different but complementary meanings. In the book, The Hierarchy of Heaven and Earth, Douglas Harding wrote, "Pluck the bee from the flower and you have neither. No creature or species or genus makes sense in form or function without the rest." And the same is true of male and female. You know, pluck the woman from the man and you have neither. Man and woman are jointly spoken, co-defining words, a dual reality like up and down, left and right, inside and outside. And it's only because we humans have this unique abstract tool of verbal language that we can communicate above and beyond the body. And as amazing as this is, it comes with a downside. Our words, abstracted from embodiment, can become confused and can lie. We can deceive and we can be deceived. We can get stuck in our heads and cease to listen to the embodied meanings. The inflation and elaboration of our ideas, untethered from embodied reality, is a decent description of what an ideology is. It's also a decent description of Tumblr, which is the online space where the ever-expanding list of gender identities was born. And I think the whole trend of the past few centuries, the emptying of meaning from the object and the gorging of the subject, is a recipe for the continuous generation of new ideologies with language to match. In the preface to The Hierarchy of Heaven and Earth, C.S. Lewis wrote the following. "At the outset, the universe appears packed with will, intelligence, life, and positive qualities. Every tree is a nymph and every planet a god. Man himself is akin to the gods. The advance of knowledge gradually empties this rich and genial universe, first of its gods, then of its colors, smells, sounds, and tastes, finally of solidity itself, as solidity was originally imagined. As these items are taken from the world, they are transferred to the subjective side of the account, classified as our sensations, thoughts, images, or emotions. The subject becomes gorged, inflated, at the expense of the object." End quote. So Lewis basically goes on to say that we need a philosophical emetic. We need to disgorge from ourselves all the meaning we stole from the natural world God made and that we've been hoarding. And that's partly why we're having an identity crisis. We've become sick on ourselves and starved for contact with an external reality that has its own inherent meaningfulness and voice. A first step in a reversal of this process is attuning to our own embodiment and learning about the communicative meanings and relationships in the natural world of which we are a part. It means getting offline and getting outside. I think if we can get out of our heads and unplug from the internet and get back into our own skin, our language will begin to reflect that attunement. It's not accidental or incidental that the concept of gender identity and being transgender are growing rapidly in a time when we're all more online than ever, especially kids and teens. That disembodiment is a prerequisite for those ideas having any plausibility.
So you wrote in this article that even though, you know, there's the real world out there that we interact with, we always have to interpret that world, and we can't help but act as mediators between our words and the physical world. So what implications does this have for Christians? Because I think we need to break some of this down. It sounds probably theoretical to some people, or maybe is this boring history? But I think we need to have an idea of the roots of this and how we got to it so that we can be able as Christians to interact with that and respond to it.
Yeah, I think there's a bent in evangelicalism towards being literal, towards a common sense straightforwardness that assumes that the world is kind of obvious and that the meaning of the scriptures is reasonably obvious too. And the benefit of both God's word and God's world being unambiguous and clear is that then anybody can understand them. So there's no need for interpretation. And if there's no need for interpretation, then there's no need for an authority or a hierarchy or an expert to have to pull rank and explain what things mean. So there's a democratic attitude behind this assumption that the truth is as plain as the nose on your face. But this assumption of obviousness can blind us to the fact that we are sometimes biased and we are always limited. You know, we inhabit a particular culture and time. We often engage in motivated reasoning, and that means making contact with the real. You know, the ability to properly perceive it and talk about it is a moral act that requires humility. In The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis says that there is such a thing as objective value, or what he calls natural law or the Tao. And this objectively moral realm calls for a subjective response from us. He writes, "Certain attitudes are really true and others really false to the kind of thing the universe is and the kind of things we are," end quote. He's saying that the universe has a nature and humans have a nature, and we need to adopt a true attitude or posture to the way things actually are. There's a sense that knowledge requires virtue. The truth isn't just going to smack you in the face with obviousness. It's more like that beatitude that says the pure in heart will see God. The Oxford scholar Ian McGilchrist writes in his book, The Master and His Emissary, that we neither discover an objective reality nor invent a subjective reality, but rather there is a process of responsive evocation, the world calling forth something in me that in turn calls forth something in the world. As music arises from neither the piano nor the pianist's hands, the sculpture neither from hand nor stone, but from their coming together. And I think McGilchrist is right that knowing reality, including the reality of sex and gender, is a both and. We have to acknowledge that every time we speak, we're also interpreting. We're engaging in this responsive evocation between subject and object. This is what we see in Genesis 2:19, when God brings the animals that he created to Adam, and he calls Adam to the act of naming. He brought them to the man to see what he would name them, and whatever the man called each living creature, that was its name. So the animals really existed, they were there, but somehow the creation wasn't quite complete until Adam participated in it through pattern recognition, through christening God's creatures with categories. And that's an act of interpretation. And so we still have to do that. God's not going to name things for us. We have to participate.
At the end of your article, you refer to certain ideas about the origin of language and the transformation of language over time, specifically ideas held by Owen Barfield. Can you tell us who Barfield was and explain his theory? And I also know he was part of that informal literary discussion group called the Inklings that is associated with J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis.
Yes. So Owen Barfield was a British philosopher and poet who, as you mentioned, was also a member of the Inklings at Oxford alongside Lewis and Tolkien. C.S. Lewis referred to Barfield as the wisest and best of my unofficial teachers. As a young man, Barfield was acutely depressed, and he described his condition in a letter to a friend, saying that he felt like he was collapsing in on himself like an ingrown toenail. He wrote, "Myself is the only thing that exists, and I wear the external world about me like a suit of clothes, my own body included." And what ended up rescuing him from this combination of lonely self-absorption and the feeling of being a ghost in the shell of his body was his experience of poetry. He noticed how profoundly particular combinations of words worked on his mind, how certain metaphorical word ensembles had power to transform his consciousness and bring delight and understanding and reconnection with nature and with the body. And this personal transformation led him to study the history of English words and to write about it. Barfield believed that language contained the inner living history of man's soul, and that words themselves have souls. They have an inner vitality that can be transformative for us. He didn't think that poetic and symbolic language played on the surface of things, as if they were merely words referring to other words. He thought that poetry formed a bridge, a connection to reality, to nature and the cosmos, that metaphors resonate with the real. And this sounds a whole lot like the patristic and medieval mindset pre-Occam, where the human mind participates in the divine mind, and we can recognize and speak about the inner logos of things because the logos himself spoke all of creation, including us, into being. Each creature and each person is a word from God. We are spoken by him, and we participate in his creativity by speaking God's words after him through acts of poetic recognition. Barfield wrote, "When we study long-term changes in consciousness, we are studying changes in the world itself. Consciousness is not a tiny bit of the world stuck on the rest of it. It is the inside of the whole world." That's his way of saying this long-forgotten truth, that the entire cosmos has the dignity of agency and meaningfulness, not just humans. Because if humans are the only seat of meaning in an oceanic void of meaningless matter, then our bodies are plastic, they're putty. They are whatever we choose to call them, and they'll be whatever we want them to be. Barfield saw the spiritual damage and disembodiment and disconnection from the world that the West has been suffering from for centuries. And he made the case through his study of the history of language that there has been a massive shift or evolution in human consciousness. It's completely anachronistic to take the way that we think, speak, and feel today and apply that to the deep past. Barfield saw that words in ancient languages had a concrete unified meaning, which only subsequently fell apart into abstract differentiated ideas. He gives the example of the Latin word spiritus and its counterpart, the Greek word pneuma. Originally, spiritus or pneuma had a unified tripartite meaning, which now we conceive of as three totally distinct things: wind, breath, and spirit. We have these three different words for three different things, two of them with naturalistic explanations and one being supernatural. But the primordial unity of pneuma was that all three are one singular reality. That was how the ancients perceived the world. They weren't speaking metaphorically like we do today. It's a change in the history of consciousness that we would think that the mind was somehow divisible from nature, that meaning was divisible from matter, that sensibility was divisible from intelligibility. Now, today, we can only bridge that gulf and attempt to get back to that kind of original participation with a meaningful cosmos through poetic language. We have to put the broken pieces back together to attempt to see the world as it really is. We have to work for what they experienced immediately and intuitively. Barfield wrote that the earliest form of human language was, quote, "a kind of participation between perceiver and perceived, between man and nature. That is something we no longer experience, only get an occasional glimpse of its quality through the creative imagination of a modern painter or poet. If you can grant this, you see language as originating in that participation, so that in the earliest stages of all, it would have to be described as nature speaking through man rather than man speaking about nature," end quote. And I think this is crucial for how Christians should approach the misuse and misapplication of the word woman today. I think that rather than arguing at the level of biology, we need to relearn how to perceive ourselves, our inherently sexed bodies, as nature speaking, as nature's voice that should be heard and respected. We need to relearn to see our bodies as icons of spiritual realities, to recognize that matter is inherently meaningful, that physicality is preloaded with meaning. We don't have to paste it on top, and it's definitely not what our words are doing. We are not arbitrary labelers of meat Lego humans. The word woman has sadly experienced a falling apart, a division, just like the word pneuma, which broke apart into wind, breath, and spirit. Because our consciousness has changed over the centuries in ways I described earlier in the podcast, woman has been divided into a biological meaning, adult human female, and an inner feeling, a gender identity, and a socially recognizable set of behaviors and preferences, gender role or gender expression. This fracturing of the word woman into multiple severed meanings is partly the result of feminist efforts to label gender a form of patriarchal oppression that has nothing to do with the female body and everything to do with exploitative men. And now, in the transgender movement, there is a reinforcement of this division and the addition of a further division between gender on the inside, how I feel, and gender on the outside, how I act, what I wear, what pronouns I prefer, etc. I don't think that science is going to be able to put the verbal Humpty Dumpty back together again and reconnect that richly varied symbolic ancient meaning of woman, which included the physical, the internal, the social, and the spiritual in one universal, all-encompassing archetype. We're going to need something creative and poetic, something imaginative, artistic, holistic, to help us reconnect these busted bits of womanhood that are being scattered to the four winds of internet discourse. And I know that the breaking apart of these meanings of the word woman had its uses and benefits for feminism as women tried to adapt to the enormous disruptions caused by industrialization, which destroyed the productive households that women used to govern and forced them to compete with men economically outside of the home instead of cooperating with men inside the home and on the land. And in the industrialized scenario of competitive unisex jobs, femininity and the kind of body that can get pregnant is a liability. So no wonder they divorced femininity from femaleness. I get it. That was a survival strategy for a particular time in history. So I can appreciate what feminists were trying to do. I know I've benefited from it. Most women have. But I think at this point now, the breakdown of the word woman is doing more harm than good. And we need to rethink this because we're not in the industrial age anymore. We're in the digital age. And that has introduced a whole new set of problems and opportunities. I think feminism needs to pivot away from this competitive mindset and figure out how women and men can cooperate again. The fracturing of meaning in the word woman is intimately tied to the breakdown of the relationship between the sexes, from a holistic conception of the family as a living organism in its own right, to the idea that each person is an isolated, androgynous individual. Transgenderism treats the human body like bits of interchangeable meat Lego, while capitalism treats people like interchangeable parts of an economic machine. So there's continuity there. So reunifying the meaning of the word woman would have to involve all kinds of broader changes and not just linguistic ones, because our entire way of life now is oriented towards keeping us as isolated unisex parts, ironically, in the name of freedom, rather than allowing us to flourish as a cooperative whole. The language is a symbol for our consciousness, and we are deeply fragmented.
What are your thoughts about the fight to retain a traditional understanding of the word woman? Do you think it's worth it? And also, what do you think are the stakes in this debate for Christians in particular?
Yes, it's definitely worth it to resist the co-opting and misappropriation of the word woman from men who want to be included in that category. And I would say the stakes are particularly high for Christians because our theology and the scripture symbolism is rooted in this non-interchangeable embodied distinction between men and women. The book of Genesis opens with God creating the cosmos ex nihilo, creating outside of himself, creating something truly other than himself. This is the way that males procreate, externally. Females procreate internally, inside of themselves. Now, as far as I understand it, the primary reason that God, who has no sex because he has no body, chooses to reveal himself in masculine language and imagery is not because he's a patriarchal sexist, but it's to convey his transcendence, his otherness, his separateness. The creation doesn't exist in the womb of a goddess. You know, creation was made to be free and distinct from God and to experience union with him through willing consent and chosen participation. There has to be a separateness first before there can be a freely chosen union. The creator makes his creation separate from himself and then woos and wins her to be in what the scriptures depict as a marital relationship with us, which is extremely different from the symbol of a gestating baby's relationship to its mother in the womb, in which consent is not part of the picture. That's why God is primarily pictured as a father rather than as a mother, to preserve the creation's freedom of response. In the Old Testament, the story of God's interactions with his people is consistently portrayed by the prophets as the relationship of God the husband to Israel, the typically unfaithful wife. At the Annunciation, we have this moment of Mary consenting to God's plan of salvation through Jesus becoming incarnate in her womb. And we have this picture of Mary as the archetype of Israel, becoming the virginal spouse of the Holy Spirit, as Catholics call her, or the unwedded bride, as the Orthodox call her. It's Mary as the singular face of the collective Israel, the singular symbol of the collective church, in being perfectly committed to God and bearing the fruit of that union. And in the Gospels, Christ applies the term of bridegroom to himself. And of course, in Ephesians 5, the Apostle Paul says, "For this reason, a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. This is a profound mystery, but I am talking about Christ and the church." And then in Revelation, at the consummation of the story, we see creator and creation united in love through this symbol of the New Jerusalem coming down out of heaven, dressed as a bride for her husband. So all of this presumes the non-interchangeability and the fruitful difference between man and woman, this sexual complementarity rooted in the body. And so if we lose this meaning of woman and man, we are at risk of losing the meaning of the entire story of our salvation. So this is not a peripheral issue. This is central.
Finally, on a much lighter note, I have a fun question for Elisa so that our listeners can get to know our authors a little bit better. And I would like to ask her, since we celebrated Easter recently this month, what her earliest Easter memory is.
My earliest Easter memory? Well, it'd probably be in elementary school. Every year, we'd get together with my dad's side of the family for Easter. And my cousin and I, who were very close in age, we'd wear these matching Easter dresses to church, usually with flowers on them and little matching hats and maybe little matching purses with our hair and curls, you know, looking very much like sisters. And neither of us actually has a sister. So I think part of the appeal was this feeling of getting to be like twins for one day out of the year. And my cousin and I are still very close, though we don't wear matching dresses anymore. But that's my earliest Easter memory.
You've been listening to episode 337 of the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Elisa Riddell. She has written a web exclusive feature article for the Christian Research Journal. Her article is called "What Happened to the Word Woman?" And you can read her article for free at our website, equip.org. Stay connected with the Christian Research Institute and all the new content we have coming your way. The best way to do that is to head on over to our website, equip.org. There you will find thousands of free resources right at your fingertips, from articles to video to audio, and it's all for free. You'll find our podcasts hosted there, as well as the Bible Answer Man broadcast, which is hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff and streams live every Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. In addition, you don't want to miss out on subscribing to Hank Unplugged, which is the podcast of Hank Hanegraaff. And in that podcast, he has really in-depth, free-flowing, essential Christian conversations with some of the most interesting, informative, and inspirational people. And in addition, he has a new series on his podcast feed called Hank Unplugged Shorts, which Hank goes into the headlines in the mainstream media and refutes a lot of those cultural issues that we have in these short podcast episodes. And there's quite a few of them. You don't want to miss out on them. Now, if you want to find some of this at other places where it's all in one place, really subscribe to our YouTube channel. It's a great way to get all of our content there, our podcasts there, and different individual questions theologically that people have that Hank answers at our YouTube channel. Now, you might be thinking to yourself, I don't know how to subscribe to YouTube. I don't have a YouTube account. Well, actually, you might just have a YouTube account. If you have a Gmail address, you have a YouTube account. Just log into YouTube with your Gmail address and search for Bible Answer Man channel, and please become one of our subscribers. In addition, if you see that bell icon right there on our front page, please click that, and every time that we have new content, you will receive a notification that new content is up on our channel for you to be able to consume. So thank you so much for the ways in which you partner with the Christian Research Institute. We are grateful for you listening and reading and watching.